Hello, I'm Dino Congonitis. This is number 0399, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0399. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, remembering the late Chuck Barris with an interview from 2003. The creator of The Gong Show was not supposed to be the host. So how did that happen?
The guy that was doing it just didn't understand the show. And the vice president of the network said, look, we don't have time to look for somebody else. Either you do it or I'm going to get another show. So I did it. And I fit in because I was actually so bad that I was just like the rest of the acts on the show. And we had a kind of a bond and so forth. And it worked. But it did change my whole persona, whatever, if I even had a persona. But I became like this crazo who was, dancing around on the stage like a lunatic. And then I had to live with that.
Military historian David O'Keefe on the 100th anniversary of the Battle at Vimy Ridge. It's an important part of Canadian history, but has it been overhyped when compared to other campaigns?
If you're talking strictly from a battle perspective, on the field of battle, what it did during the war, certainly there were other battles like the Battle of Hill 70 a couple of months later, and of course the last 100 days of the war in 1918 where the Canadian Corps really shone. And as a matter of fact, even Sir Arthur Currie, Canada's most famous World War I general, said, I don't know why we're necessarily celebrating or commemorating Vimy in this way, as we had much more important and impressive battles later on.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Want to go to the zoo? Then head to JFK.
There's lots and lots of animals that are shipped back and forth from New York City to zoos. It's a pretty big business. The fact of the matter is, when you're having that many animals, including lions and tigers and giraffes, you really have to have a good facility. Well, Kennedy Airport, which is one of the largest airports in the world, they've actually built a whole new zoo. I haven't seen it yet, and of course the public hasn't seen it yet, because right now it's just meant for transferring of animals. But they're saying that it's come out so nicely, and it's such a lovely zoo, they may actually open it to the public.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0399 was Dino Congonitis, who is a fine, fine cameraman and human being. He's also a video editor and director of photography. You can check out his work at his company website, which is motionedge.com. That's motionedge.com. Dino also worked with me for a brief period of time when we were both at Global News. Again, excellent cameraman and a wonderful human being. Thank you very much, Dino, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show even bigger and better as a radio experience. It's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A woman shot her love rival, who was shopping for sexy lingerie at Victoria's Secret. Columbus, Ohio police said that they have arrested 22-year-old Aniqua A.E. Williams after being accused of shooting 23-year-old Denisha Elmore. According to the police investigation, Williams and Elmore were fighting over a man for more than a year. You know he must have been enjoying that, huh? Yeah. When Williams saw that Elmore was buying sexy lingerie at a Victoria's Secret's pink store, apparently to entice her boyfriend, she pulled out a gun. Williams then shot Elmore in the chest. Elmore was rushed to the Ohio Health Grant Medical Center, where she is said to be in stable condition. Well, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, or packing heat. I wonder if the boyfriend is concerned about her shooting him. Although, now that I think about it, She's going to be away for a while anyway, so that's not an immediate concern. Okay, so this next story is sad and pathetic on so many different levels, as if that last one wasn't. A Pennsylvania man wearing a T-shirt that says Drunk Lives Matter was charged with DUI in Newville by the Newville police. 44-year-old Elwood R. Gutshall, wearing a green St. Patrick's Day T-shirt, was charged March 19th with DUI after police said he committed several traffic violations while driving his Ford pickup. His blood alcohol level was found to be 0.217%. He was charged with the highest level of DUI, also driving under suspension, because in these stories, they always have a suspended license, and traffic violations. Court records show Gutshall has had a number of DUI convictions in the past, along with a 2009 guilty plea for assault. I guess we're going to hear more about a moron like this until he finally kills someone. Remember, folks, driving is a privilege. It is not a right. You'd think there were laws to prevent people from repeating such heinous activities, but perhaps the problem starts with lawmakers. Case in point, when Ohio State Rep. Wes Rutherford ran for re-election, the Butler County Republican Party instead endorsed his challenger. Since Rutherford was a person who had a, and I'm doing air quotes now, partying problem, that might be reflected by his driving record. Rutherford had racked up 13 traffic tickets and had been in 7 vehicle accidents over the past 17 years. The 33-year-old Rutherford was re-elected, but now he's been arrested for drunk driving after he was allegedly found passed out in a McDonald's drive-thru. Police also found a loaded gun in his car and added a charge of improper handling of a firearm in a motor vehicle. That's a felony, and a conviction would disqualify Rutherford from office. Now, while the local Republican Party calls Rutherford unreliable and unfit and asked him to resign, House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, who is also a Republican, calls the arrest an unfortunate hiccup, and I guess he doesn't really know what hiccups are then, if that's the case, and urges patience with the process of the court. Things happen. I'm not going to sit here and beat the guy up or kick him when he's down, Rosenberger said. Well, here's a tip. When party officials say one of their own is unfit for office, believe them. Also, at this time, I always like to remind people about the beauty of democracy. The population always gets the government it deserves. Anyway, finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Illinois man sentenced to 10 years in prison for bilking an acquaintance out of $93,000 has started 2 political action committees from behind bars. The Center for Public Integrity reported that Angelo Pesci is a convicted felon and cannot vote, but there is nothing stopping him from creating the fundraising entities. Papers filed last week with the Federal Election Commission identify the 51-year-old Pesci as the PAC's treasurer and agent and list his mailing address as the Taylorville Correctional Center in Central Illinois. The filings don't explain who or what will benefit from the donations, but the name of one urges impeachment of an unnamed target, reference with an expletive, and the other appears to support pedophiles. Federal law doesn't ban felons from soliciting money via PACs. Let me repeat that. Federal law doesn't ban felons from soliciting money via PACs. Go figure. So, how do you feel about PACs now, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program, shall we?
This is the Stuff File.
Last month, we lost another legendary celebrity. On March 17th, Chuck Barris, the self-proclaimed king of daytime, died at the age of 87. Barris was the creator of The Dating Game and The Newlywed Game and the host of The Gong Show. But he also did much more than that. He was a songwriter, penning such hits as Palisades Park. He even claimed to have worked as an assassin for the CIA, a claim which the CIA has vehemently denied. That last story was chronicled in his book and subsequent film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Well, in May of 2003, I had the chance to talk to Chuck on my old radio show when he was releasing an album. It was entitled Confessions of a Dangerous Singer. Here's a portion of the interview that we did back then.
Throughout your entire career, you've been a master at dealing with PR and press. You did it so well when you were doing the game shows, and then you vanished.
Yes, I did. I vanished. Well, the fun went out of everything. I mean, the fun went out of television for me. I had been in it for almost 20 years. It was tremendous. While it was in the beginning and all the way up, but then about 1980, it just dropped out. It was too much. I was getting all sorts of criticism from television critics, and it just lost the fun. So I sold my company and went to Europe to do another daydream, just to write the great American novel.
Did the criticism really bother you?
Yeah, very much. You know, it's funny because we got it. My first show was The Dating Game, and it went on the air in 1965 in December. And the day it went on, the Monday, the Chicago Tribune art section headline said, "Daytime television hits all-time low." I could never understand what was so horrible about The Dating Game. It was just this little girl asking for you guys for a date. And it never stopped. It just went straight on. I was the guy the critics love to hate. In the beginning, I thought TV criticism, you know, what is that? That they're criticizing stuff you do for free, stuff you get for nothing. If they were criticizing books or movies, that makes a difference. And so I was able to kind of slough it off. But after 15 years of it, it just got to me.
Well, you did the Dating Game,
Newlywed
Game.
And about 12 other shows.
About 12 other. And then the Gong Show comes along.
The Gong Show came along. That seemed to be the crescendo of all of that criticism, you know. But it was a huge hit. And I, you know, I became the host because the guy that was doing it just didn't understand the show. And the vice president of the network said, "Look, we don't have time to look for somebody else. Either you do it or I'm going to get another show." So I did it.
Who was the original host?
The guy's name was John Barber. But, you know, he just didn't see the lunacy of the show, and he was playing it too straight. And I fit in because I was actually so bad that I was just like the rest of the acts on the show, and we had a kind of a bond and so forth, and it worked. But it did change my whole persona, whatever, if I even had a persona. But I became like this crazo who was dancing around on the stage like a lunatic, and then I had to live with that.
Well, I was a teenager when that show came out, and I must admit I came home from school every lunch hour to catch the Gong Show.
the other thing was, it was so much fun to do. You know, I could have replaced myself easily after the first year, and when the show was solid and it was on the air. But it was just too much fun to give up doing, I would sing with those guys that were playing when we were in commercial, and the whole feeling was fun.
The one thing I never got, because I was always a fan of television while growing up and tried to keep up with the news of what was going on within the industry, you had such a link with game shows and ABC, yet you did the Gong Show with NBC.
Well, ABC was, I worked at ABC, I actually was a page at NBC, but I got into game shows at ABC because they were just getting into their broadcast schedule. It started at 5 o'clock at night on ABC, and they were backing up all the way to 10 o'clock in the morning, by hour by hour by hour, 5 to 4 to 3 to 2, and they were doing game shows. That's how they were getting into the into competition, because they were cheap, and if they succeeded, they succeeded quickly, and if they didn't, they could be replaced. And I just watched all these game shows come and go. And that's why. And when I finally thought I could do a better one, which was than they were doing, I quit and did The Dating Game and brought it right back to ABC. And that started a long line of shows that I gave them.
So NBC ended up with The Gong Show, though.
Yeah, well, by after I don't know, about 1970 or so, I was going elsewhere. I was into syndication. I was on CBS. I was on NBC with various shows of mine. And The Gong Show just happened to end up at NBC.
Getting back to your music a little bit, the album entitled Confessions of a Dangerous Singer, one of the songs on the album is a song that you wrote. Well, there are several songs that you wrote, but one that was a hit, as I mentioned in the introduction, Palisades Park.
Yeah.
How did that come about initially as a songwriter for you?
Well, that was very strange. You know, I can't read music, and I really can't play any instrument really well. But at that time, I was working on Bandstand as an ABC, the liaison between the network and Bandstand and Dick Clark. And I don't know, I was just into all those songs, and I was just driving down the West Side Highway, and I looked across the river, and there was a place called Palisades Park. It was an amusement park. And I don't know, it gave me an idea for a song, and I hummed it into an audio machine, a little audio tape recorder, and I gave it to somebody who made a lead sheet, and I sent the lead sheet out to, you know, Bobby Rydell and Freddie Cannon and Paul Anka and guys like that, and Freddie decided to do it. And it was really the B side of the record. It wasn't supposed to do, you know, the A side was something other, entirely different song, and it became the hit.
What was it like for you when you first heard that on the radio?
I got to tell you, Peter, to this day, it's just amazing to me. When I first heard it on the radio, I was in California. I was driving in a car. I had to pull over in the side of the road. And it's just that same feeling today. If I hear it on the radio, I'll turn that radio up. I'll stop what I'm doing. It was the first thing I ever created that was a commercial success of any kind. And it just has the fondest memory for me.
You have re-recorded that song and put it on your new album.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were in the studio, I did not intend to do Palisades Park. I figured you can't touch Freddie's record. That's sacrosanct. But the guy said, let's do it. You know, it's a simple song, so let's just do it. And we did it, and it came out, you know, much better than I thought it would.
How would you describe the album? Because you do a lot of standards on the album, right?
Yeah, you know what? It's an eclectic sort of thing, Peter. I recorded about 20 songs. I think there's about 16 on the album. But I would just was all over the place. But I found that the songs that I did best and were most comfortable with were some of them. Those old standards, you know. But, you know, there's some country in there, and there's even a Mummer song that I did, you know, at the end of the record, because I'm from Philadelphia, and the Mummer's Parade's a big thing. And if I were to do another album, I would just stick to those standard songs, you know, You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You, and all those things, because they're the ones that I enjoy the most. So, you know, they come out the best.
Are you thinking of doing another album?
Well, let's see what this one does. You know, I would love to. I've got about 20 other songs that I would, you know, like to pick from, because they're so much fun to sing. But it'll just wait and see, you know, if there's a reason to.
Lots of people have read your book. Lots of people, lots more have seen the movie. I'm not going to ask you the stories about the CIA, because I know you don't answer those.
That's right.
So I won't go there. But the one thing I will ask is you had a lot of tormented times in your life, and
yeah.
we got a sense when we saw something at the Gong Show that you were having fun. But the movie and the book tells us somewhat of a different story. Are you having fun again?
Oh, sure. You know, that's a little bit of a misleading thing. There were three times in my life. I'll be 74 years old next month. And there have been three times in those 74 years when I was really down. One was when I thought the dating game was sold. I was broken and in debt. And the network actually turned it down the first time. Then a month later called me up. When they turned me down, that was a low, low ebb. When I left in the 80s, when television wasn't fun anymore, that was a low time for me too. And you know, I went to Europe. And then when I came back after that and I started trying to get back in shape again and get busy again, I've inadvertently found out that I had lung cancer. And That was another low point. But when you add them all up, each of those low points were like a year, year and a half, two at most.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what, 3, 4, 5 years out of 70. So 60 years have been nothing but fun, and it's fun again. So those really weren't. At one point in the Gong Show, it wasn't very much fun to do because I was tired and I was being really crucified by the critics, and it just lost it. And at that time, I was feeling down, but that was just a moment in time when you think about it.
Would you like to get back into television?
Well, you know something? I just thought of a couple of ideas that are so good that I really didn't want to go back. I really kind of still don't, because it just wouldn't be as much fun as it can't possibly be as much fun as it was when we were starting out. And I don't know how anything could be more fun than when I was doing the Gong Show. It's got to be a second best at best, but I don't know. I keep looking up there and seeing stuff, and I know these a couple ideas could probably be really successful, and I'm tempted.
What do you think of television today, particularly reality-based television?
Well, you know, it's my feeling that game shows, which is what reality is, in a sense, game shows mirror the times that we live in. I've always felt that. I think in the 60s and 70s, although we had a list of words we couldn't say, like God or toilet seat or make love, we still had more fun, and the shows were more fun. And I was accused of humiliating contestants, but I always swore that they were having a good time. Now, I think the times are stressful. I think a lot of people, the countries, broken up about 9/11, things like that. And I just think, I don't want to put more emphasis than it's due, but I think the shows are mean-spirited, and I think they're kind of hostile, and it just doesn't seem like people are rooting for losers and the people to get embarrassed, and that's what I think the big difference is.
Do you think that the critics who vilified you so many years ago have reflected and looked at the stuff you did with a fresh pair of eyes, especially in light of what's on TV today?
There's no question about it. Absolutely no question about it. I mean, I'm glad I lived this long to see some kind when I left television, I felt that nobody in the country liked the shows I did, and particularly they didn't particularly like me either. And I don't think it was that bad when you go back and think about it. And one thing about the movie coming out, the book coming out, the shows coming back and all that, I mean, they're going to do Dating Amy Newlywood game again on prime time. They're going to do Gong Show again on Warner Brothers. That must say something.
Hmm. Are you involved in any way, shape, or form with the revive shows?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. And which is kind of hard at times because they really were my babies in a sense. But when I sold the company, I sold all the rights, and that was okay too because that was then, and now's now.
Well, we wish you continued success. You know, as I said earlier, we had fun. Primarily in the Gong Show, we had fun watching you have fun.
Yeah, I was having fun, and I'm having fun again, Peter. I swear to goodness I am.
I'm glad to hear it, and I thank you very much for talking with us on the program.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Chuck Barris, who was promoting his album entitled Confessions of a Dangerous Singer. That was just part of the interview we did back in May of 2003. Chuck Barris died last month on March 17th at the age of 87. Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of the interview with Chuck where he talked about his music, and you'll also hear a couple of tunes from his album, all as part of your Patreon rewards. Just go to our Patreon page and become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program.
Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Canada's role in the Battle of Vimy Ridge 100 years ago. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is also available on Patreon.com. This Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com and be part of the Stuff File Nation. Okay. An Indian River County Sheriff's deputy patrolling in Vero Beach, Florida, couldn't help but notice a man was surfing atop a moving and unoccupied car. When the deputy activated his emergency lights to pull the man over, he jumped off the roof, ran alongside the car, reached in the window, and jammed the stolen Camaro into park. The deputy could hear the gears grinding. Said the deputy, the driver then threw his arms and hands in the air while facing me and laid his body face down on the ground and then volunteered, there is weed in the car. 33-year-old Nicholas Christopher Yepes was arrested on multiple charges and his bail was set at $23,000. Yeah. I hope the owner of the vehicle will be warned about the extensive transmission work his stolen vehicle is now going to require. As for the alleged driver, how high do you have to be to want to hang 10 on the roof of a driverless car? Seriously. And clearly we seem to have a theme today of people driving under the influence, because here's another one. A California Highway Patrol officer found a car on the Coronado Bay Bridge that had run out of gas. The officer used his cruiser to give the motorist a push to get off the bridge and followed as the car rolled through a stop sign in a San Diego neighborhood, crashed through a fence, and hit the stairway of an apartment building. Fire rescue crews had to come out and help the people out of the upstairs apartment. The driver, Anil Nazir, was arrested on drunk driving charges. So basically, the car was out of gas, but the driver was plenty gassed. Yes. And after being sentenced by a judge, 27-year-old Daniel Boria apologized for his dangerous actions, but he said he didn't regret them. Sorry, not sorry. I have the greatest story to tell for the rest of my life, he said. He pleaded guilty to dangerous operation of an aircraft after tying over 100 helium balloons to a lawn chair and flying over the Calgary Stampede in Calgary, Alberta. He must have got this idea from Wile E. Coyote. He must have. Anyway, it's unknown what height he achieved, but there is an estimate of some 14,000 feet, Judge Bruce Fraser said. At some point, a commercial aircraft, the offender called it a 747, passed underneath him. Boria said he understood the risks, but if you don't do anything, you won't be in trouble, but you won't get anywhere either. Judge Fraser had a different perspective. The stunt was unconscionably stupid, he said. There was nothing fantastic, fun, or exhilarating about it, as the offender was quoted describing it. It was dumb and dangerous. Boria was fined $5,000, plus a $1,500 victim impact fee, and a $20,000 donation to a local charity. But he was all smiles during a post-sentencing interview with reporters. It's pretty hard to take it seriously when you guys are asking me these questions based on me flying a lawn chair lifted by helium balloons. Yeah, that would have made a pretty rainbow if it had been sucked into a jet engine. Mm-hmm. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Ohio police say a suspected shoplifter called 911 for help after she hid in a fitting room at closing time and got locked inside a department store. Brimfield Township Police say surveillance video from the incident at a Kohl's store late last month shows her taking clothing items, then realizing she's trapped in the store near Kent, roughly 35 miles southeast of Cleveland. Police say officers already were headed to the store when she called 911 because she had set off alarms. WJWTV reports that 35-year-old Joanne Havens told police she heard the store closing announcement and simply didn't leave in time. But officers say they found stolen items in her purse. Joanne has pleaded not guilty to a misdemeanor theft charge. You know, one has to learn that you can only do late-night shopping at stores that are actually open late night. Yeah. Anyway, on to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program. Canada became a country 150 years ago, but there are many who claim that Canada's emergence as a nation came 100 years ago during World War I and the Battle of Vimy Ridge. This month of April marks the 100th anniversary of that battle, but while it is a major source of pride for the country, is the battle itself as important as we make it out to be? Joining us to talk about the battle and its important place in history is award-winning military historian David O'Keefe. David is also a history professor, television producer, and documentarian, and the author of the best-selling book, One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe. He joins us via Skype from here in Montreal. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Always a pleasure to have you back on the program with us once again, sir.
Always a pleasure to be here.
So just the other day we were talking about this, and I mentioned that I used an analogy saying that Vimy Ridge seems to be, from a religious aspect of it, a religious analogy, it seems to be the Easter to Christmas, meaning that Easter is the biggest holiday in the Christian religion, but Christmas seems to get all the headlines. Is that the same situation here with Vimy Ridge? Is Vimy Ridge Canada's Christmas in a way, as far as the way it's treated among battles?
Yeah, I certainly think you can argue that. If you're talking, you know, strictly from a battle perspective, on the field of battle, what it did during the war, certainly there were other battles like the Battle of Hill 70 a couple of months later, and of course the last 100 days of the war in 1918, where the Canadian Corps really shone. And as a matter of fact, even Sir Arthur Currie, Canada's most famous World War I general, said, I don't know why we're necessarily celebrating or commemorating Vimy in this way, as we had much more important and impressive battles later on. So without a doubt, I think your analogy does hold true.
So how did Vimy Ridge become so important? And is it a situation where it was a morale-boosting effort by Canada to make this battle that important?
Essentially, yeah, in a nutshell, it was. I mean, one of the reasons why Vimy Ridge is so important to Canadians is because we were hell-bent on making it important for Canadians. At the close of the battle, it was without a doubt, on a tactical sense, an incredible victory in itself, in the sense that, you know, for several years, there had been no real victories of any import by the Western Allies on the Western Front in World War I. So in this particular case, you've got the Canadian divisions all coming together for the first time. They had been under British command, and now they were still under British command, but they had been grouped together. And they ended up taking the objective, which was a ridge. So this wasn't just a question of, for instance, grinding down your opponent in a seemingly futile operation, like a lot of World War I battles were up to that point, but you had an objective that the Canadian Corps achieved. They took the ridge, which by World War I standards was indeed remarkable. But I think what's happened after the war was that the Canadians were looking for some place in Western Europe to commemorate their sacrifices in the war. And there were several different places that were offered to Canada by the French government as a place for memorial. And it was Vimy Ridge that was chosen, and it's still a bit murky to this day as to what specifically went into that decision-making process. But either way, in 1920, Vimy was chosen as a site of eventual memorial, which is what you see standing there today.
And I don't want to underplay at all the importance of Vimy Ridge, even though we're talking literally about the importance of it. there, it was a victory, but at a terrible cost.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you lost, or the Canadian Corps lost 3,600 dead in just 4 days of battle, and another 7,500 wounded. And, of course, that's not taking into account the Germans on the other side. So you're talking about a very heavy death toll just in the first few days of what was the bigger campaign known as the Campaign for Arras, Arras, France, which was a 40-day campaign, which on average took the lives of about 2,000 to 3,000 men a day over a 40-day period. Vimy was the opening act, if you will.
So I remember hearing about Vimy Ridge when I was a kid. Of course, it's grown in stature now. It's the 100th anniversary. When did the idea of commemorating Vimy Ridge, when did it become the legend that it now is to many Canadians?
Well, it kind of had a roller coaster journey, because at the end of World War One, a lot of people weren't really interested in commemorating battles per se. They wanted to commemorate the suffering in World War One. So that's one of the reasons why Vimy was chosen at the beginning, not necessarily for the battle, but more for a site for commemoration of the suffering. And so from there, things started to change in the 1930s when the Vimy Memorial was actually erected and opened for the first time. And there was a major pilgrimage. Now, that pilgrimage wasn't just a question of going over to give, you know, to pay homage to the men who had fallen. But by that time, there was a real Canadian nationalistic fervor that was starting to build. And of course, this was just before World War II. So you had a mix of emotions, a mixed bag of sentiments in the late 1930s, when close to 100,000 people descended on Vimy to pay their respects in one way or another. So from there, you can see it start. And of course, that was the first rise in the roller coaster. And then it started to dip in the 1960s when people started to look at military memorials as being militaristic rather than pacifistic. And then it started to rise again, probably in the early 90s. So a lot of times when you get to the seminal moments in the history of a particular battle, so for instance, at the 75th anniversary, 25 years ago, the 90th, 10 years ago, and now the 100th, people tend to become much more interested in the battle, and they tend to sort of hoist their own expectations upon the understanding. That's what we have with Vimy now.
Well, tell us about the battle itself. I understand Vimy Ridge was a heavily fortified 7-kilometer ridge that the Allies wanted their hands on, right?
Yeah, well, the Germans had taken it in December of 1914 in heavy fighting with the French. And both the French and the British had attempted to take it back and did capture it briefly. But the key was they couldn't hold on to it. And they ended up losing a lot of men when the Germans pushed them back off the ridge and retook it. And essentially from about 1915 onwards, the Germans had built it up into a relatively impregnable defensive feature. Now, of course, the Western Front is pretty flat, so anytime you have a small rise, essentially it's going to be a dominating feature. So this is how the stage was set then for 1917. From April 9th to April 12th, when the opening of the Arras campaign started, Vimy, like I said before, was the opening act.
Now, again, I do not want to take away from the importance that Vimy has had in Canadian history over the years. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned earlier, there were some even more important battles from a Canadian point of view. Were there not during World War One?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Vimy is always seen as the beginning of the year of professionalism for the Canadian Corps. In other words, they had suffered through 1915, 1916, and absorbed some of the bitter losses and the lessons from the Somme and from Ypres. And now they were starting to apply them. So in many ways, you can argue for the Canadian Army, it's a bit of their coming out party. In other words, they did put the Allies and the Germans on alert that now they were moving towards a highly effective professional fighting force, which of course was just solidified as 1917 turned into 1918. In 1917, you have just 3 months after Vimy, you have what is considered to be one of the classic battles of attrition by the Canadian Corps, which is at the Battle of Hill 70, which is just outside of Lens. And then, of course, later on in 1918, you have what the Germans called the blackest day for the history in the history of the German army, which was August 8, 1918, when the Canadians broke through their lines at a place called Amiens. That started a series of Canadian victories that led to the end of the war in November 1918, and this was known as the Last Hundred Days. So there are several other battles that I would argue would eclipse Vimy from a military perspective, but for whatever reason, still have yet to capture our hearts and our attention.
Well, is part of it the fact that this was the beginning of Canada coming out from under the shadow of the British military?
Well, certainly that's one way that it can be interpreted, and I think that certainly is correct. At this time, not necessarily 1917, but afterwards, you also see that the idea of nation building. In other words, you know, Canada was born on Vimy Ridge. Now, of course, that's a highly ultra-nationalistic interpretation of things, considering Canada had already been around for 50 years as an official dominion. But of course, even before that, it goes back a couple of hundred years. So as a result, the interpretations are very interesting and quite controversial, but certainly it plays an aspect. And when it came to the British military, without a doubt, we were now starting to prove our own. And there was a bit more of autonomy, if you will. Not full autonomy, but certainly now we were allowed to do things, relatively speaking, on our own compared to what it was like in 1914, 15, and 16.
Fascinating stuff indeed, and still a very important date in history. David, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I mentioned in the introduction your book, One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe. I understand that you're working on a couple of other books, too. I won't ask you about them because I know they're coming out later. Will you come back on the program and talk about them when those books are ready?
Oh, I'd love to. Anytime, Peter.
Excellent. Thank you very much, sir, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Pete.
Military historian David O'Keefe. Again, his book is One Day in August, The Untold Story Behind Canada's Tragedy at Dieppe. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0399, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Now that baseball season has begun, I'd like to tell you about one of the most important people in the game you've probably never heard of. Dr. Creighton Hale was a young college professor when, in 1955, he joined Little League Baseball to lead its safety efforts. He would eventually spend nearly 60 years with the Little League, including 20 as its president. He invented some of the most important safety equipment still used today, including the double ear flap batter's helmet and a chest protector with a throat guard for catchers. Let's be fair, though. I probably would have never heard of Dr. Hale if not for a speech he gave to Congress. You see, he went to Washington, D.C. to reveal how the lawsuit problem in America had affected his organization. He testified that the Little League had to spend more money on liability insurance to protect itself from lawsuits than it spent on bats, balls, and gloves combined. How did things ever get this way? Learn more about how other organizations are affected by excessive litigation. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City, the city that never sleeps. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Always a pleasure to have you on the program. So I understand some defense attorneys are being kept up at night themselves because they're keeping their clients in jail so they can't get deported. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's a strange situation. New York considers itself a sanctuary city. That's the number of cities in the United States. Actually, there's quite a few that refuse to listen to instructions from Washington when people are illegal aliens, you know, who've just arrived in the country, sneaked in, so to speak, come over the border and all of that. And what happens is that, in theory, when they arrest somebody for bank robbery or some crime, big crime, petty crime or something, they are supposed to report the criminal, the illegal alien, to the federal government, who in turn will deport the person. New York City has carried it one step further than even not disregard, you know, disregarding the law, in the sense that if a policeman reports an illegal alien to the federal government, he can actually lose his job. I mean, it's a crazy set of circumstances. So what lawyers are finding out is that if some illegal alien has committed a petty crime, rather than plead the case and get the guy back out on the street, they let him stay in jail. And they say, well, as long as he stays in jail, the federal government can't deport him. Like I say, it's a very bizarre thing, but it's something that's prevalent in New York City.
Wow. Now, even when they do deport someone, usually what happens is they take them to the airport in some sort of custody. They keep them in holding for a certain period of time until their flight is ready to go. They put them on the flight and they send them out of the country. I also understand they're keeping a lot of animals at JFK.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting story, and I wanted to share that with you and your nice listeners. There's lots and lots of animals that are shipped back and forth from New York City to zoos from other countries. It's a pretty big business. There's nothing that's dishonest about it, but the fact of the matter is when you're having that many animals, including lions and tigers and giraffes, you really have to have a good facility. Well, Kennedy Airport, which is one of the largest airports in the world, has never really done much for the animals. It kind of just warehouses them in a dusty, cool warehouse for a few hours and then transfer them onto the next plane. Well, what they've done at JFK is they've actually built a whole new zoo. And I haven't seen it yet, and of course the public hasn't seen it yet, because right now it's just meant for transferring of animals. But they're saying that it's come out so nicely and it's such a lovely zoo, they may actually open it to the public so that the public could say, hey, you want to go for a ride at a zoo? Let's go out to Kennedy Airport.
This is a story of practically biblical proportions, because it sounds very much like Noah's Ark.
Yeah, well, if you had a pet giraffe, you'd want it taken care of at the airport.
I understand this facility is something like 178,000 square feet. That's pretty big.
Yeah, well, everything. Listen, whenever you talk about New York City, you know it's the biggest, the largest, the best, the greatest. It's just the nature of New York City. But if they were going to build a zoo, they decided they were going to build a really big one and a really nice one. It's probably the newest major zoo in the United States.
Now, most of the stories we talk about when we discuss things here with you, the Gabby Cabby on this program, are items that I find on your website, which is Gabby.com, G-A-B-B-Y.com. And you gather a lot of stories either from the streets when you drive your cab or from news publications that you follow and that you share on your website. I bring all that up because I'm going to talk about this next story, but I'm going to talk about it under protest because I got a problem with this even being a story. But according to the New York Times, as you've posted on your website, Melania Trump has issued her own executive order. She refuses to share a bed with Donald Trump. Now, the reason why I say under protest, why do we need to know this? And even if it were true, why should we care?
Well, I'll tell you why you should care, because it's an indication of the venom and what's gone on with the whole campaign when it was working. Now that it's supposedly over and the guy is the president, it continues. I don't think in my lifetime there's been just such an onslaught of filthy stories and gossips about a guy who happens to be, whether you like it or not, the president of the United States. And I use that as an example of what's going on, because the Daily News is doing it, the New York Post is doing it, the New York Times is doing it, the Associated Press is doing it. So I'm not doing it to glorify. I don't think it's true at all. But the fact that a paper with the supposed prestige of the New York Times would report it is really, I think, reprehensible. Come to think of it, it's probably reprehensible that I'm passing the story on, but my only plea on that one is that I'm just doing to show you how low politics has become in the United States.
I'd also be curious to find out if they took a complete unbiased survey of married couples in general. I mean, you'd be surprised to hear the numbers, because I've actually done shows on this topic before, of married couples who are perfectly happily married couples who sleep in separate bedrooms.
Yeah, well, you know, sleeping is sleeping, and the other thing is the other thing.
Yeah.
You know, they don't necessarily have to coincide. But I think when it comes to the President of the United States, certainly a newspaper of the kind of prestige that the New York Times allegedly has shouldn't be published. I feel a little bit guilty about because I'm perpetuating it, but it's just, really, as I said to you before, I have never in my own lifetime seen such venom in our politics. And right now, it's sort of like Trump against the Democrats, Trump against the media against Trump. You know, it just, it's, you know, and we're not really doing what we should be doing to take care of our obligations in the world when we're messing around with this stuff.
Okay, so meanwhile, while the First Lady is living in Trump Tower in New York City, something's going on, I believe, three floors below the penthouse. The Russians are there.
Well, that goes to this craze now about wiretapping. You know, President Trump had alleged that his phones were tapped by Obama, which is really quite a sketch. I guess maybe the FBI is watching too many James Bond movies. But it seemed that there was a Russian mob, because you know you can blame everything on the Russians. There was a Russian mob, and the FBI was wiretapping their phones to get information. And in the course of tapping those phone lines, Trump's phones were somehow tapped. I mean, as I say, it comes out that something stayed out of the James Bond movies. The point that I'm also making in showing this story is that this is probably true, and when they talk about the fact that it's all very involved and very complicated, getting permission to tap somebody's phone, I'm here to tell you that that's a bunch of baloney. All you have to do is get the cooperation of a phone man, and you can tap anybody's phone. So when Trump says, my phone line was tapped inadvertently or what have you, no, I don't buy it. It was tapped because somebody wanted to tap it.
Hmm. Who's listening into your calls, by the way?
You are right now.
Okay. Now, how many people nowadays make up the population of the city of New York?
Well, supposedly about 10 million, but nobody's completely sure.
Okay, so about 10 million people. 10 million people, that's a lot of garbage. Where does all that garbage go?
Well, we ship it to Canada. No, we don't, of course. But maybe we do come to think of it. No, it has to be processed and separated and resalvaged and all of that. And then there's different places, landfills and things like that. New York, it cost us millions and millions and millions of dollars to get rid of our garbage and waste and trash and all that. And we're very effective about it because in New York City, you better take care of the cleanliness of your own property because we actually have a law here that says you have to sweep in front of your building, your home, your business, and in 18 inches into the street where you're going to get a ticket from the sanitation police. And yes, we do have a sanitation police. These are guys who look like they're cops, and I guess they are cops, and they ride around the city giving you a ticket if you're dirty.
Wow. And also in the news, talking about celebrities for a minute here before we let you go, one celebrity, Michelle Pfeiffer, she's playing Ruth Madoff in a current movie, and you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, the thoughts I have, and they're my thoughts, is I think she was just as guilty as her husband. I think she got off of doing any jail time, probably in exchange for the fact that he did give up certain information, and the deal probably was, if you do this, this, and the other thing, we're not going to put your wife in jail. Because there was no reason for her not to be jailed. I mean, for her to be involved with millions and millions and millions of dollars of theft, I don't think there should be a movie glorifying her. But hey, that's Hollywood.
But does your loving bride know everything you do during the day, Peter?
Absolutely. You know what's the test of a good marriage?
What's that?
If a husband can pick up a wife's purse and go looking for her driver's license, or vice versa. If a woman, for some reason, needs your driver's license, you say, oh, sweetie, it's in my wallet. Yeah, that's part of the deal with marriage, and I think I can testify to that, having now been married over 40 years.
Mazel tov. And finally, Celebrity sighting of the week. You saw the front man from U2.
Yeah, he's more a New Yorker. And you, of course, the master of all trivia, must know this. He probably spends more time in New York City than he does anyplace else. And it's not that unusual to see him on the street. And I've seen him a few times through the year. But he's a New Yorker. There's no shortage of that.
Mm. Well, you see everybody. You know everybody. I'm going to let you go because it sounds like you're just a little bit under the weather. I will remind people that your website is www.gabby.com, and people can send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thank you very much for being on the program, sir, and get well.
Oh, thank you very much, because I do have a terrible allergy problem right now.
The Stuff File.
And we're into the home stretch here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have just one more item to get to, and you know what that is, boys and girls? Yes, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
An Illinois man is facing animal cruelty charges for allegedly punching a donkey in the face, an attack the suspect recorded and later posted to his Twitter account. According to police, 18-year-old Lucas Dietrich slugged the donkey while visiting Willoughby Farm in Collinsville. That's an Illinois city about 12 miles from St. Louis. Dietrich was at the farm late last month attending a birthday party. Investigators allege that Dietrich punched a moor, a 13-year-old miniature Mediterranean donkey, below the animal's right ear. The donkey was not seriously injured during the attack. Police learned of the donkey punch after being tipped that a video of the incident had been uploaded to Twitter. In short order, police identified Dietrich as the donkey assailant. Dietrich was arrested on a pair of misdemeanor animal cruelty charges and booked into the Madison County Jail. So, here we have a story of an ass hitting an ass. Now, why? Oh, why? Unless you've been overcome by watching Mongo in Blazing Saddles, would you find it appropriate to cold cock a donkey and then post a video of that transgression on Twitter? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0399. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0399. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?